Hey there, how's it going? Welcome back to another episode of In the Barn. I'm Robin.
And I'm Kelsey, and in today's episode, we're going to take a look into what sometimes feels like a shortcut in proper equine healthcare, but is it? We're talking hawk injections. Does your horse need them? Are you now stuck giving them forever? Are all joints created equal? And what can you even have injected into their hocks? Stick around to find out. So I have to be honest, this research has been a journey. Like, this has been a trip. I thought this episode was going to be really simple, really straightforward. We're just going to talk about a couple products, boom, bang, bing, in, out. That's not what happened at all. I'm going to try not to rage and scream into the microphone while I record this episode, but no promises, because this is definitely been interesting. I've learned a lot. I have learned so much.
Just warn us when we need to turn our volume down.
I will definitely, when we get there to like some of these substances, I will absolutely warn you that it is time to like way dial the volume down. Like
that bad?
I'm going to try not to be too ragey. I'm going to try not to be too like, what the heck is going on? But it's interesting. It is interesting for sure. So for today's episode, in order to keep us from having a five-part episode on hawk injections, we have tried to keep this really specific in our research. So what we're talking about when we're talking about hawk injections is things that are drugs. So we are looking at FDA-approved drugs that can be injected straight into the hawk joint itself. So those are IA injections or intra-articular injections. That's going to rule out a lot of substances real quickly that we're not going to have time to talk about or we're just not going to discuss today. Things like Legend and Adequin, while approved for IA injections, they are not approved to give to the hawk or put into the hawk. And I think I figured out why, but then I get super confused when I talk about another drug that is approved for the hawk. So I'll explain when we get there. But we're also not going to be looking at things that are considered therapies like stem cells or IRAP, because those are not drugs. Those are therapies. They have a different sort of process by which they work.
Also, we're not talking about supplements that are advertised as supplements and then injected into the hawk, because those, once again, are not drugs and they are not approved.
Okay, actually, we're going to talk about one just because it really looks like a drug. It's not Summit.
Oh.
It's a different one that's doing something similar to Summit. And I also have a quick Summit update when we get there, because y'all, Summit is making the up to stuff again. So this episode has a lot packed into it for sure. But yes, these are drugs, not supplements for the most part, except for there is one I need to talk about, because it actually, my vet did ask if I wanted to give it at one point, and I was like, no, I'm okay. mostly because my personal philosophy, I knew nothing about it, but my personal philosophy, like as my horse has retired, is that hawk injections are really about maintaining performance level of your horse. That's really the reason why we choose to give hawk injections and to look at some of these treatments, is so that we can maintain the performance of our horse. And I like, my personal philosophy is that I kind of want to avoid those sort of decisions, whether they're harmful or safe or helpful or whatever. I don't need to inject my horse so it can continue to perform to a certain level. I'm fine retiring a horse who has like no interest in being ridden and just wants to eat in the pasture or whatever, or find other things to do with my horse. That's a personal philosophy, and why I've not really pursued any of these with my older horses.
And I'm of the same mind. My philosophy is just kind of, for me personally, if my horse isn't sound without injections, I don't necessarily think they're sound with injections to be ridden.
Yeah.
I've been fortunate enough not to have to come across this in my ridden work, but with my own mare getting older up in the years and she is, you know, arthritis has come into the picture, I've just really scaled back what we've done and what she is happy and content with. And that's all I need to do for the two of us. I'm okay with scaling back with what her body needs and what she would like.
Absolutely. And I think there is definitely a school of thought out there that, you know, says if your horse isn't sound, you know, without injections, they also aren't sound with injections. So how you know, proceed from there is up to you.
That's our own personal philosophy. What we're really curious about with this episode is the hawk injections themselves that other people are giving, because we want people to have access to all the information. What is the best out there for you to use? If you've done all your research, you've talked to your vet, and this is the path that is best for you and your horse, then we want you to have the best information out there to make that decision, because that is what's important, is we're all just trying to do what's best for our horses.
Exactly. So with that, since we're talking about drugs, I just kind of want to walk briefly through the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration's drug approval for animals, how that process works. It is different than how drugs are approved for humans. It's different. And just walk through that process quickly before we kind of talk about the hawk and the structure itself and get into the research behind lameness and the substances. So here we go. For drugs that are going to be available for animals, they go through what is called a new animal drug application process. They do this through the FDA. They have a whole application you fill out. And that means that when a drug is created, when they submit for approval, they get what's called an NADA number. And this number, I'll give it to you when we get to the substances I looked up. I'll give you their number because this number can be really useful when you want to look up information in the FDA's website, in their register, when it was approved, what was it approved for. There's often a lot more information you can find if you have that number. If it is a generic medicine, so it's a duplicate of a new animal drug, then it gets the abbreviated new animal drug application, which is similar. You just go through it a little bit faster because the drug's already been approved. You're just making it under a different name, essentially.
Okay, makes sense.
For this, it's the application itself is pretty simple, and the FDA, like in their how does it work webpage, equates it to like a college application, like a high school senior filling out their college application. Basically, what you're doing is you're, you know, providing information about how the drug, what it is, what it does, how it was determined it was safe, how it was determined it was effective. You have all that information in this application that is then submitted to the FDA and the Center for Veterinary Medicine. So the Center of Veterinary Medicine works under the FDA, and they're the ones that give the stamp of approval for this project, for the drug to be made. If a drug has FDA approval, that guarantees that there's going to be a certain strength to it, that there's a quality, that there's purity, and it is consistent batch to batch. So for the FDA, they regulate not just where it's manufactured, but where those ingredients that are being used. They have a whole process of approving these things and monitoring to make sure that it is a quality ingredient that is being put into that product. Anytime a drug, the manufacturer changes, or the ownership changes, or an ingredient changes, then the FDA does require a new noticing period to be applied for. So you basically notice that something major on your application has changed. It goes out for public comment, and then the FDA like reapproves the drugs. And I talk about this because you can't just change where something is being manufactured without notifying the FDA. And a lot of this has to do with like monitoring imports, what's being imported into the country or exported, and where it's coming from. So you do have to have all this paperwork in line and updated and approved.
Sounds like a headache, but I'm glad they have to do it and I'm not the one that has to do it.
But it also really kind of starts to point out the differences between supplements,
right, yeah,
and drugs, that there is a big difference between these. And while getting something approved for an animal drug is a lot less stringent than getting something approved for a human drug, you do have to go through testing. You do have to prove that it works. And basically different biologists, all kinds of different specialists are gonna review this application, and they're gonna look for errors, they're gonna look for issues, and then they're gonna give basically their approval. You don't have to have as many test subjects for an animal drug that you would have to have for a human study. You can get away with maybe 46 horses versus like hundreds of people or hundreds of different levels of testing you'd have to do for humans. It's a little bit different. The other thing they check for when they're reviewing these applications is the drug's impact to the environment, as well as the safety to people that are handling it. So they want to make sure that this drug isn't, you know, oh, that's why a lot of times you're going to see right on packaging, not intended for horses for human consumption. A lot of that has to do with how long this drug stays in the system and what we know about how it interacts for the human. That is just like a blanket warning that they put on basically everything as a way to like not have to look any further.
Right. Yeah.
So most drugs are going to have that warning on them. But it's a pretty simple process. I'm not exactly sure how long it takes, but it is reviewed. To become a new drug, you do have to go through an application process, get all this approval, blah, blah, blah.
Well, it gives you a little bit more peace of mind than what supplements have, which is basically no oversight.
Right. And it's not just supplements, but it's also devices, which is actually what the one product we're going to get into. They claim that they're a device.
Oh, that's right.
And not a supplement. And devices, you basically, for a device, just have to prove that you're the same thing as something else that's already on the product. You're no more dangerous than something that's already available on the market. Okay, so I also want to just throw out that I may use the abbreviation AAEP multiple times throughout this episode so that I don't have to say American Association of Equine Practitioners. But for those of you who are from outside the United States, that is basically our overarching vet board or association that you can be a member of. You get to sign up and pay your membership dues. You don't have to be, but most vets choose to be part of the AAEP and get continuing education credits and all kinds of things through them. And then the other thing before we dive too much further is I do want to explain that I am not negative against hawk injections, right? Like I said, if you need them, that's great. Especially if you're looking at something that is a drug, we can understand that drugs already have to go through an approval process. We can understand that there is some sort of safety around giving them and that they do work to some degree. When I am negative about hawk injections, it's because there's a lot that goes into determining if you need hawk injections, if your horse needs them, right? And when do you need them? How often do you need them? What substance do you use? It's not something that should be the go-to, the shortcut, the cheap option. Well, it's almost always the hawk, so we might as well inject them and look no further. If you are getting injections multiple times a year, or you have to start giving them frequently, that is a sign it's not the hawks. That is a sign that you've picked the wrong target. Really, I'm going to push throughout this episode for you to make sure that you go through the proper channels to do a lameness exam, to block joints, to do x-rays at a bare minimum before deciding the hawk needs to be injected. There's no shortcut. You don't get to just inject hawks because it's probably the hawks and they have arthritis.
Right. And we're just trying to be more transparent with hawk injections because I'm going to tell you, when you don't know much about it and you go and start trying to research and read about it, it is so freaking confusing. And it doesn't make it any easier as you, as the consumer, to figure out if it's the right option for you and your horse. So just making this information more transparent is gonna help a lot.
Well, and then there's so many worlds and disciplines where hawk injections are just normal.
Right.
And so you will see articles for those different disciplines. You'll see magazines, you'll see blogs, you'll see forums, and you'll see vets that specialize in these different disciplines that hawk injections are standard. The reason we're doing this episode or wanting to look further into it is because we have a friend who, I don't know if she's listening, but hi, Hannah, if you are, who, you know, she was in a situation where a vet was pushing her to get hawk injections for her horse, and her gut said it wasn't the hawks. And lo and behold, you know, with a different vet looking at the horse and doing a bone scan and doing a lot more work, it turned out it was the shoulder and some issues in the other end of the horse. And I think too often hawk injections are just low-hanging fruit and are easy place to start and get stuck into. And just because it was the hawks once doesn't mean it was the hawks the next time. So it is important that we give sort of we look at the whole horse, the whole body, when we're making these treatment decisions, that it is not just going to be, oh, the horse is of a certain age doing a certain sport, therefore it's the hawks. It's the whole body we have to look at. And we have to consider what that impact is. Why would it even be the hawks at this point?
Exactly. And hawk injections are something that is so commonly advertised and you see everywhere. I mean, just in my recent eventing magazine I got alone, I think there was like 3 different advertisements for various hawk injections. There was like Adequan, and then I think there was like another one, but you just see it everywhere and it feels like it's constantly being pushed on you. Well, maybe it's not necessarily the right option.
It probably isn't. So let's get into, since you've said hawk 1,000 times, let's talk about the structure itself, because I think that's really important. While this is probably basic information to a lot of you, I don't know why I didn't know some of this stuff. So, and I feel like I'm a pretty educated person when it comes to the horse. And even I was like, what? There's what? Hawk, also known as a tarsus joint, is very similar to the human heel. That's like our matching body part is the heel. Did you know that the hawk consists of 4 joints?
No, I didn't. I thought it was one big joint.
I know. Neither did I. It's 4 joints.
I didn't know it was 4 joints. I was like, what?
I know. Oh, I'm glad you know now that at least you did some research. We know you started to make it more confusing. So right, there's 4 joints. The from top to bottom is the tibiotarsal joint, the proximal intertarsal joint, the distal intertarsal joint, and then the last one is a tarsometatarsal joint. And those are the wrong names. Those are not the names for the joints.
Why would you tell us that?
The reason I'm going to tell you that and I'm going to use those is because those are the common names. They are technically incorrect. AAEP makes a big stink about it in a lot of their information, a lot of their conference documents. Those are the wrong names. However, those are the names that you are going to find everything referring to. Unless you are looking at research studies, you very rarely will find the correct names. So instead of tibiotarsal, it is the tarsocrural. This is why. The second one's the talocalcaneocentral. Then you have the central distal and then the tarsometatarsal joints. So that was the same order, but only in the research literature are you going to find the correct names. Everything else, blogs, vet web pages, like credible resources are going to use the common names, and I can pronounce the common names, so we're going to use them.
Okay.
The tibiotarsal joint, which is the top one, is where the tibia and the talus bone meet. So the talus bone is like one of the first of the short bones within the hock joint. That performs about 98% of the motion in the hock. And then the next joint down does about 2% of the motion in the hock. And then the last ones, the distal inotarsal and the tarsometatarsal joints, the last two, which are the short little bones, barely even move. They really don't do much of anything. And actually, if they fuse, can be a good thing for a horse that has arthritis if those last two joints fuse, because then that usually gets rid of a lot of that lameness. The hock acts like a joint or like a hinge. So it's a little bit different than the knee joint, the carpal joints, or the fetlock joints, where it acts like a hinge. The movement of the hock is linked to the movement of the stifle. I didn't realize that it makes total sense that the stifle and the hock move in coordination. They move at the same time. So when the stifle flexes, the hock flexes. When one extends, so does the other. So when you're looking at lameness and issues with the hock, you may also be looking at issues with the stifle, that those could be, you know, you could have issues with one that is causing issues in the other location because these two joints are connected. The hock has several short bones in it. Those short bones that make up the bottom two joints are shock absorbers. And then you have the calcaneus, which is the bone that like sticks out the back and gives the hock its very specific shape. So let's talk about when a horse needs to be injected and how you tell. So I found an AAP article. So this is on their website, called Lameness and Joint Medications. And it was written by two vets and published in 2016. So there is some stuff that needs to be changed since 2016, but that's okay. What they talk about in this article, I think, is really important, because they talk about how complicated it is to not only diagnose, but all the different things that could be going on with a hock when determining what is going on, like with these joints. It is not going to be just a simple case of arthritis. Every hock is not created equal. Not only are the hocks in your horse's own body not created equal, but your horse is going to be very different than the next horse. And so determining what's going on, what type of traumatic joint disease, what type of osteoarthritis, is going to be very unique to your horse, right? There's can be lots of different things, from ligament tearing to fragmentation, cartilage to calcification, like cartilage turning calcification or calcification on its own in that bone. So it's really important that when you're looking at these issues, you have to know what's going on. And in many cases, you're going to need to do nerve blocks. You're going to need to do radiographs. You're going to need to do ultrasounds, computed tomography, magnetic resonance or imaging or MRI techniques, diagnostic arthroscopy. Like, all of these are part of figuring out if this is the joint. There is no gold standard for diagnosing joint disease in horses. Radiographs, taking x-rays, can maybe show something, but also radiographs, x-rays can look clean and they're not be any issue.
Right. Yeah.
So one of the big goals, according to the AAPE, is to give interarticular injections, so injections into the joints, before problems occur. So how do you go through a lot of these processes and try to figure out if something is occurring or not occurring, and when do you give these medications? So there is this like balancing, do I give them sooner or do I give them later? But a lot of the research indicates that the more severe the injury, the better these things work. So it's this balance of, I have to do all this work to find it, but can I find it sooner, or can I find it, you know, soon enough to do anything? There's just so much that goes into this.
Yeah, but I don't know how much I like that idea of giving it before there's ever even a problem seen, because injecting a joint is intrusive.
Absolutely. I think the idea is not that necessarily before, like, preventative, as much as it is about not waiting till it's the worst case scenario.
Okay.
So when you're seeing early signs, that's when we need to act. But there may be early signs that aren't showing on if you're relying on x-rays alone.
Okay, that makes sense. I get it. I'm with you now.
However, it's often not the hocks that are the issue, or the hocks are often part of the issue, but not the only issue. So the AAP AP also had a 2012 conference paper titled How to Inject the Tarsal Joints. And this kind of goes through the two different places where you would inject the joint. And they, even in this article, conclude that the clinician should be aware that a positive result for IA injections does not always indicate that there is disease in these joints, and that negative results of injections may be the result of how the drug was administered to the joint, and that it may not have been administered properly because injecting HOX is really difficult. Even as the AAP is putting out how to do this, they're reminding clinicians that it is likely, or there is a possibility, that just because you see results does not mean it had anything to do with the HOX.
Okay.
And I want to continue to push this point home because a 2019 study titled Reliability of Equine Visual Lameness Classification as a Function of Expertise, Lameness Severity, and Rater Confidence. So this is a really interesting study. What they did is they went to a vet conference. They showed, these were equine veterinarians at a seminar. They had a whole class and they showed them horse animations on a screen. And these horses were either sound or had a varying degree of unsoundness in one of, or maybe multiple, legs. This information, right, because it's an animation, and they know which they know for sure, right, which leg is lame. And they found that it did not matter how experienced the vet was, how many cases they had seen, if they had done a lot, medium caseload, whatever it was, there was no significant effect on experience being able to correctly assess the lameness of the horse. So,
oh no,
experience does not play in for visual. And again, this is visual. And I say this because okay, I think a lot of times we see horses, you know, jogging in front of us, or we see them on Facebook, or we see whatever, and we want to make critiques about how lame they are. And these vets couldn't do it for subtle lamenesses, because that's often, again, right, if you're going to go early, if you're going to try to get ahead of and diagnose arthritis early stages, you want to look for subtle lamenesses. Obviously, extreme lameness is pretty easy to spot. That's not why we call our vets out, because, I mean, we do call our vets out for extreme lamenesses, but we're not saying, you know, what's going on, doc? I can't figure out what's up. For extreme lamenesses, we can find that. It's the subtle lamenesses that is where we find a lot of the vets start to look for what could be going on. Could it be the HOX? So for subtle lamenesses, errors often resulted from not noticing that the front was lame. So they kept wanting every time to say it was like the hind end. So they kept incorrectly picking the hind end leg, and they kept incorrectly saying it was the hind end when it was the front end that was lame.
That's actually really funny you mentioned that, because I have done that a few times where, like, I was watching a video the other day and I was like, that horse is definitely not sound, but I couldn't figure out which leg it was. And I kept like going back and forth if it was like the hind leg or if it was like the diagonal front leg. A few days later, the girl put out another video and was like, well, she's lame, like abscess just blew out of this foot. And I was like, ah, see, I was wrong. I kept thinking it was the hind leg.
And horses are really tricky because typically they go lame in diagonal pairs.
Right.
So if you are seeing like a lameness in the back hind, there's a good chance it's actually the front opposite front leg, or vice versa. So horses are really tricky because they do a lot of compensation like that. But I wanted to talk about this study because I thought it was really interesting that vets want to constantly say it's the back end and it's not. And then they get the front leg wrong, you know, to a point where it was statistically obvious. And it takes a little bit to be statistically obvious sometimes in these studies. Yeah. So I point this out because I think a lot of us, again, this is where I have that issue with skipping. If you haven't done the nerve blocks, if you haven't done x-rays, if you haven't done a full body lameness evaluation, it's premature to do HOX injections. And this study is why it's premature. The second study, a 2020 retrospective study, looking at the analysis of lameness localization in Western performance horses, 10-year review, found the same thing. 56% of Western pleasure horses were going to be lame on the front end. And these are Western pleasure or reining horses. And I understand that, like, those sports come with their own like set of body issues, right? Like, there is a certain way that those horses are ridden that can lead to certain lamenesses. But I bring up quarter horses because HOX injections are really pushed on the quarter horse industry.
Yep.
Barrel horses, I don't think there's a barrel horse that does not receive HOX injections out there. So they looked at 2,267 lameness exams.
Ooh, that's a lot.
That's a lot over a 10-year period, and found that 40% were in the front end.
Okay.
16% to the HOX.
Oh, wait, I thought you were going to say 60. Okay, so 40% was the front end and then 16 was the hind end?
Was the hock region, yeah. So 40% was the distal forelimb.
Ew.
And then 16% was the hock joint itself. And then 9% was the stifle. And then that, like, the rest was just, like, other, right? Like, there's lots of other reasons to be lame.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I just think that's really interesting that 40, like, that 16% of the time it was the hock region. And that total 56% of the time it was on the front end. So I think that's really interesting that it's often not the hocks. They did find that it was more likely to be the hocks in reining horses.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Well, yeah, right. That makes sense. And then Western performance. But overall, out of 2,200 horses or 2,200 lameness examinations, it was 16% of the time it was the hock.
Well, it's an interesting number or interesting percentage that doesn't quite match up with the amount of advertisement you see for hock injections.
Absolutely. And so that's why I wanted to bring this up and mention this study is because I think there is such an approach that I think a lot of vets rely on experience. And they say, you know, the last time I've done this enough, the last time it was the hocks, we're going to do the hocks again with it. You know, we just, this worked with the other horse, we're going to do it with this horse. And there's nothing wrong. I want an experienced vet. You know, experience is key to being a good vet and to helping, you know, take care of these horses. But if you're always looking for it to be the hock, it's always going to be the hock. Like, if you're not looking for it elsewhere, it's not never going to be elsewhere.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
So AAP also published on their website Understanding Lameness. So forelimb lameness is easier for most people to recognize than hind limb lameness. The mechanics of the forelimb are a lot more easier to understand and allow the hind or the untrained eye to observe them. Hind limb lameness is generally much more difficult to visualize and diagnose. This is especially true of subtle upper hind limb conditions, not the hock, but farther up like the stifle and the hip. So I think a lot of times we may not be understanding that there's stuff going on further up in the horse than we're seeing it, right? It could be the stifle, it could be the hip, it could be these other joints further up in that hind end. And vets just aren't well trained, well adapted to see some of this stuff. And they do, the AAP does push vets to remember to use things like radiographs and ultrasounds when looking at hind end lamenesses, because you need to be able to see deeper into that body and not just assume it's the hock or assume it's other, you know, these simpler structures.
Right, exactly. And not all vets have that portable x-ray or like have a place that you can bring your horse to get x-rayed.
Right, yeah, doing x-rays to the hip is very challenging and doing, right, like, you know, getting these bigger images absolutely are very challenging. You need to be able to come into a clinic, you need to have access to the equipment, or be able to go to a university that has a lot of this equipment. So it's not cheap, and I think a lot of people want to choose injections because it's cheaper. You know, why not just rule it out? And I really want to keep pushing that hock injections is something I feel like you rule in. You know, you not rule out, like, you know,
yeah,
you have to do all this information to put it on the list of possibilities. It's not that first thing. Hopefully at this point you have a little bit of skepticism around whether your horse needs, or you have enough information to determine if your horse needs hock injections. But I did look at a few vet web pages. So these are websites for veterinarians, especially performance veterinarians, that talk about signs that your horse may need a hock injected. So if you're thinking about it, you're wondering if this applies, and some of these, if your horse maybe has something going on, here are some of the symptoms or signs your horse could need its hocks injected. Your horse might be moving slower than previously. Again, this comes straight from vet web pages. God. Like,
is this one of those all-encompassing lists where they just list anything that could be wrong? And they're like, yeah, it could all be hock injections.
Pretty much. One of the complaints I get from trainers is that their horse is not reaching as far as they used to. Sometimes it's the horse does not feel comfortable. They have a choppy gait or they're bunny hopping. Swollen joint. Which, I mean, that's a good indication, right, that there is actually
an issue. That's a fair one. That's a good one.
That's a fair one. If the lameness improves with exercise. So the rule of thumb is that if lameness improves with exercise, there is a high chance it is joint related rather than soft tissue like tendons or ligaments. And I just want to know whose rule of thumb that is. Because what? I did see this mentioned a couple of times on different web pages, but like, that's not soundness.
Right. So this is something I used to actually believe in. I was like, oh, they just warm up out of it. Until I realized that, like, my horse was out in her back and I was an idiot. Or not idiot. I just didn't know. I was always told that, like, if they warm up out of it, they're fine. But that actually not entirely true.
And then these ones come from WikiHow, which...
Why are we listening to WikiHow?
WikiHow, we have to. We have to not... If we're making a WikiHow for if your horse needs hawk injections, we don't need hawk injections.
We've gone too far.
We've gone too far. This list includes a change of character, such as trying to bite an owner when grooming, bucking, or general bad temper. Your horse may also demonstrate pain while being tacked up. They don't move quickly or easily. They don't jump as high as they used to, or they begin riding heavy on the forehand. Also, I saw these not just on WikiHow. Like, those are also on all, like, a lot of vet pages. So the only reason I wanted to discuss these signs is because I wanted to kind of discourage people from just assuming that, like, my horse doesn't jump as high as they used to. It must be the hawks. Like, don't jump to the conclusion that something super vague is the hawk. It could be 1,000 different things. You know, horses carry 60% of their weight on their forehand. Anyways, they're not jumping as high because it hurts the shoulders, right? Like, you land on your shoulders. But I guess if you're not taking off, that's your hawks. I don't know. Like, you don't, like, think about how many different components there are to jumping high. A really common one for horses that don't want to jump anymore is often they have a rider who is now landing on their back. That is, like, really common for, like, my horse bucks when I ride bareback and jump on bareback. Well, are you landing on their back every time because now you don't have stirrups? So, like, there's so many different pieces to this.
Yep.
The last little piece to making you maybe slightly skeptical or questioning hawk injections just based on non-substance related information is the fact that vets are really bad at injecting the hawks and getting the right location.
What? No. Say what you said.
Vets miss a lot.
No.
But it might be okay. So a 2015 conference paper presented by AAEP at their annual conference found that vets are accurate 96% of the time when they're injecting the bottom joint, so the tarsal metatarsal joint. They are accurate 96% of the time. When they go to inject the distal intertarsal joint, which is the next one up, so you have the cannon bone, then you have the first short bone, and then the second short bone, so that second joint, they get it right 42% of the time.
Oh my goodness, that's a steep decline in accuracy.
Yeah. So there's a chance that getting the right joint, because right, here's the thing, the joints that don't move, the short bones and the non-moving joints tend to cause some of the most pain in horses. And so absolutely, if you're thinking, well, why would you inject a joint that doesn't move? They actually tend to cause a lot of pain in the horses. And once they fuse, that pain goes away. But then you also, there's absolutely, you inject the joint at the top, which moves a lot more. So like, there is reasons why you would inject multiple locations in the hawk joint. So there are absolutely reasons to target different joints, but finding them can be really challenging. And 42% of the time, clinicians in the field, they were hitting the target.
That's over 50% missing. That's a 58% miss rate. That's an F.
That's an F. That's an F.
We're both familiar. That's an F.
Though, if you have any understanding of hawk joints, do know that there is a lot of diffusion or communication between the joints. This is something that we agree upon basically across the board, is that if there is an injection that is given in one of these joints, it is likely to
spread,
and go into the other joint. So even if you miss, it may not be the end of the world. Also, do keep in mind that these hawk injections, that the medicines, are not the only thing that diffuses. So do nerve blocks. So if you've relied on a nerve block in the hawk joint and the stifle to target, to try to figure out which of the four joints or which of the joints, they also that nerve blocks also diffuse and do also provide therapeutic levels of the nerve blocking agent to the other joints, meaning that you could be numbing more than the joint you think you are.
Gosh, horses are complicated.
They super are. So are we ready to talk about the substances?
Yes, we are. And in case you guys haven't noticed yet at this point, this is going to be a long episode because there's a lot of information to get out about hawk injections.
And that's what, like, this actually, so what's funny is Robin's going to give you the list of things you are going to inject into your horses. I'm going to give you the list of the things you're not going to inject. So my part's going to be really fun.
Which I didn't know it was going to take this turn. I didn't know that. I thought there was going to be more than that you could inject.
Me too. I absolutely thought this list, so when we started, I thought I was going to talk about Adequin and Legend, right? I thought those were the things you inject into the hawks and then steroids, or that there was like one or two other things that you could inject into the hawks.
Right.
So we're not going to talk about Adequan because it is actually only approved for intermuscular, which is the most common one. And then their IA version, the interarticular, the joint one, is only for the knee and the carpal joint. So we're not going to discuss Adequan. We're going to have to do a different episode to discuss that because we obviously don't have time. But if you are curious about Adequan and want to look up more information, their NADA number is 136-383. And that will give you all their FDA paperwork, their approvals, all that kind of information. Again, I think these numbers are really helpful when you're trying to like track some of these products, and especially just not just for these drugs in general, but for all drugs. So the next thing we're not going to talk about is Legend. Again, Legend is only for injecting into the knee and the carpal joint, or the knee slash carpal joint and the fetlock joint. So they do get to inject into the fetlock joint. But we're going to talk about something in a minute that is similar to Legend. Adequan is a polysulfated glucosamine glycan, and then Legend is basically hyaluronic acid. It is a form of a hyaluronic, it's a sodium salt. So we'll talk about something that's similar to Legend in a second. But my understanding is why these things are not approved for the HOC and not necessarily used for the HOC, though I do absolutely believe, looking at vet web pages, looking at forums, that these things do get injected into the HOC that is not following the label. So like legally, that's questionable, but these are safe products. They do have some sort of benefits when given. Their intramuscular version and their IV version have all shown to have some sort of benefits. But the reason is that there's not a lot of room in the HOC. And I forgot to look this up. I meant to. But when you inject things into the HOC, you actually have to drain off synovial fluid first. And I don't know if you do this for knees and fetlocks because I didn't research them. But you do have to drain out synovial fluid before you can inject anything in. And because we know steroids are probably the best thing, they have the most healing potential. When you do injections into the knees, into the fetlocks, you're typically giving steroids along with Legend or along with Adequan. You're typically not doing these on their own, but maybe you are. And there's just not enough room to get steroids and Legend or another solution in, because you also have to do antibiotics. We didn't used to do antibiotics, but we're coming around to it. We think it's important to give antibiotics into joints when we inject them. So that's my understanding, is that there's like just not enough room to squish everything into a HOC joint.
Okay, that would make sense.
So we're also not going to inject polyglycan into our horse's joints. Polyglycan is actually not a drug. It is a device, and we're going to talk about it now because this was one that my vet asked if I wanted to do. Now, polyglycan is often recommended. You could do it intramuscularly, but it is also absolutely recommended to be injected into the HOC by the manufacturer.
Oh.
So it is basically a hyaluronic acid and a chondroitin sulfate and glucosamine. So if you listen to our supplement episode, you know all about those products, all those ingredients. That is basically the joint health trifecta.
Right. Yeah. That's the joint supplement. Their key ingredients.
Those are the key ingredients. That's all of them, all pumped into one. How awesome. According to their website, polyglycan is specifically formulated to mimic the physical properties of normal equine synovial fluid. This product's intended use is in the synovial space directly in the joint. In horses, as a post-surgical lavage, a synovial fluid replacement, or a viscose supplement. I did look up what a viscose supplement is because it sounds kind of cool. It is basically just hyaluronic acid in joints. Like a viscose supplement is something that a human could get. It's just injecting however much hyaluronic acid you want to straight into the joint. I don't know why it gets such a cool name.
Okay.
Is polyglycan a drug? According to their website, it's not. Polyglycan is a medical device. It achieves therapeutic effect by mimicking the physical properties of equine synovial fluid. The mechanical lubrication and the cushioning provided by polyglycan helps to protect the joint in a non-chemical, non-metabolic manner. That's like very specific language they chose there.
Yeah.
So they claim they are a device. So an animal device, as defined by the FDA, is an instrument, apparatus, implement, machine, contrivance, implement, in vitro regiment, or other similar or related article, including any component, part, or accessory, which is intended for use in the diagnosis of disease or other conditions, or in the cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease in man or other animals.
Wow, that's broad.
Or which is intended to affect the structure of any function of the body of man or other animals.
Oh my God.
Right, like to me, I kind of get the argument for why this is a device, But their examples for, this is the FDA's example for devices, includes needles, syringes, surgical instruments, prosthetic devices, x-ray equipment, certain diagnostic test kits, and dental appliances. It's none of those. I would say it's none of those. Also, the FDA totally agrees with me. So in 2019, ByMedia, which is the corporation that owns polyglycan, was sent a warning letter by the FDA saying, hey, knock it off, you're a drug, and you need to get approval to be a drug. So they wrote a letter basically saying that this letter concerns your firm's marketing of polyglycan and all the different forms of it. We reviewed a polyglycan product label and your website in October 2018 at the internet address ByMedia's US, where you promote these products and sell these products to distributors. The product label and claims on your website establish that these products are intended for use in the mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease in animals and or to affect the structure or function of the body of animals, which makes them drugs under the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. As discussed below, these products are unapproved new animal drugs and your marketing of them violates this act. Statements that prove that this is a drug and not a device are: polyglycan is a patented formulation designed to replace lost or damaged synovial fluid. It contains naturally occurring components of synovia that plays a central role in maintaining homeostatic environment of the joint, and polyglycan introducing it into the synovial space as a post-surgical lavage, synovial fluid replacement, or viscous supplement to assist in the normalization of the joint. So all of that proves it's a drug. So the FDA has sent them a letter. As far as I can tell, ByMedia has not responded at all to this, and this is still an open case where the FDA is trying to get them into compliance. They are a drug. They are trying to use the device loophole in order to not have to
meet all the requirements.
And the interesting thing that they do, and I don't think they have to do this, but they choose to do this, is they only sell their product to vets. I can't purchase it. But that would only apply if it was a drug, right? It would not apply if it was a device. And devices, like, the FDA doesn't regulate devices. They just, basically, you just have to agree that it's not as harmful as anything else that's out on the market. And they honestly just rely on the companies to monitor themselves.
Well, clearly you can't trust the companies.
No, you can't. So wanted to do a little bit further research, like we do. I decided to go to ByMeta's webpage, and I wanted to see, like, what else can I learn about polyglycan. And I was impressed. They have links to actual research on their website. Like, real research.
Do they really?
I was actually really impressed. And it wasn't just, like, the flashy PDFs where they've, like, edited and cherry-picked the information. They actually linked it to real studies, including a 2011 study titled Comparison of Synovial Fluid in Middle Carpal Joints, so this is looking at the knees, undergoing needle aspiration infusions with saline infusion and infusion combination of the joint, blah, blah. Basically, this 2011 study found that you might as well just inject saline solution because it works just as well as polyglycan.
Oh.
And that the biggest improvement was that the injection itself on day one actually produced the most synovial fluid because it irritated the joint. It had nothing to do with the product itself.
So is this the research they're providing to show that they are a device and not a drug?
So here's the thing, right? They're not going to, if this is the research that's being done, they're not going to get approval because you have to prove to be a drug that it works better than the placebo. The placebo works just as well as the product. So you can't get approval to be a drug. So then your fallback is to be a device.
Their advertisement is off. They're making false claims.
Yes, yes. They are making false claims. Absolutely. Saying, but I did think it was interesting that they provided this research on their webpage, even though it absolutely does not support them. If you are looking at purchasing polyglycan or your vet recommends it, I would say no. First off, let them work their issues out with the FDA. They have not proved that this product works. The FDA is actively trying to get them to stop advertising this product for false and misleading claims and for selling an unapproved drug. They also, since 2018, the FDA has issued 21 letters of this nature. So the center, not to ByMedia, sorry.
Oh, okay. Oof.
Here's the woe part. 21 since 2018, two of them are to ByMedia for two of their products.
That's still a high amount.
That's a high amount. There's only one other company that is like a fisherman. There's like a fish doctor who's like selling Anyways, I loved his company name. It was Dr. Fishman, and the FDA had to write a letter to Dr. Fishman. And I was like, oh my gosh, is it Seth Fishman? Wasn't that the guy from the Juice Man? So I was like, does he have a company again? Is he doing bad stuff? And then I realized it was fish medicine. There is no Dr. Fishman. So I thought it was hilarious that the FDA wrote a letter to Dr. Fishman. Like, there's no Dr. Fishman. Okay, so they also have another product called Ovamed, which is used to suppress the heat cycles in mares, and that has false and misleading claims as well, and they received a letter in 2019 for that one. I would stay away from polyglycan. I would stay away from Bimeta. Yes, this product is being sold to vets. They need to prove that it works, and there's a lot of other issues with this company. They did another study in 2020 to look at the effects of articular cartilage lubrication with the viscose supplement in vitro and in vivo following osteochondral fractures in horses. So once again, they took their product and they wanted to see if it worked. This time, they found that it worked mildly better than saline solution only in the first 4 hours after arthritis was induced. So they induced arthritis, we know how that's done, into the knee of a horse and found that at the 4 hour mark, slightly better synovial fluid production than saline solution. However, like, this study is ridiculous because 16 horses had arthritis induced and then were euthanized 17 days later. You know your product doesn't work. There is no reason to introduce this and then kill the horses 17 days later. Oh, great. My horse lives for 2 weeks after I give your product. Are you kidding me? Why would you do research? That is not why people are giving hawk injections, because they hope their horse lives for 2 weeks after the surgery or after the first treatment. 17 days. 17 days to find out this product doesn't work. Are you kidding me?
That's all sorts of dirty and wrong.
And so this study has some other issues with it. The next one being they suggested that repeated applications are necessary. So we need to sell more of this product, which is great because this company has been bought out by someone called Arthrodynamic Holdings. Arthrodynamic Holdings is not a medical company. They are an investment firm that is using polyglycan as a money-making tool. They absolutely want a study that says you need to sell more of this product.
Yeah.
And again, not a drug, a device. So honestly, this company is not much better than Summit.
No, they sound like all sorts of shady.
I'm confused as to how this product is actually making it to vets, because we don't have time to go into it in this episode, but a lot of these companies use questionable tactics to get their products promoted and get vets to sell them. Now, I'm not talking about coupons and rebates. I think coupons and rebates are fine, but there are other companies, I wonder if this is one of them, that use things like free nights at casinos to get vets to sell their products and use other unethical tactics to get this product into the rotation so that vets recommend it over other products. Please, please, please just stay away from polyglycan. It does not work. If you want to buy polyglycan, just inject saline solution or have your vet inject saline solution. The results will be the same. You also do not need to support an investment firm. Investment firms don't buy products because they love the medical industry and because they want horses to be happy and like healthy. That's not why they do that.
No, that's definitely not it. Wow, yeah, stay away from them and their parent company. Sheesh.
And don't worry, they are now going through FDA approval to try to make this into a human drug out of this as well.
Well, of course they are.
Because I mentioned them, Summit. You guys want a little Summit update before we do our next product?
Also, I will say Summit is our one episode that we have gotten the most negative feedback of people just coming out of the woodwork being like, how dare you say Summit? How could you say this? You clearly do no research.
Okay, I would love to hear from someone who is a sales rep for Summit so that I want to hear their justification for this one. So if you go and look up Summit Joint Performance, they no longer exist. Their website is gone.
What?
Yeah, it is now Summit Animal Health, and they are only advertised on a website called Eterna Pure, which absolutely sounds like a scam itself. Because it is.
Oh, do they have to change their name because of all their claims? Oh, my God.
Yep, they had to change their name. So it is now Summit Animal Health. They have a new logo. They were only Summit Joint Performance for 2 years.
Right.
2 years before they had to change their name again. And it looks like if you go to Eternum Pier's website, it looks like they've partnered with this, like, really fabulous, I love a good stock photo company. They talk about how they've partnered, air quotes, with Eternum Pier. Eternum Pier doesn't exist. So Eternum Pier, on their business license, is being run. It was originally started by, I think, Richard Dill is his name, which is like one of Dorian Farmer's, who is the inventor, promoter, owner of Summit Joint. It's one of his like partners, probably even an alias. I don't even know if it's a real person. But anyways, Eternum Pier was started by Richard Dill, but then he handed over control to, I cannot remember this company, something like Noro Technologies LLC, which now runs Eternum Pier. But Noro Technologies is actually owned by Dorian Farmer.
Oh.
You can't can't partner with yourself. Like you can't partner with yourself. That's not how that works. And so you can now only buy Summit Joint Performance products from Eternum Pier's website, still an MLM. If you have not checked out our episode, it's episode 37 on why Summit is a joke. Do not use it. But I really want to know what excuse have you guys been told that like the haters be hating and so you had to change your name? Also, you can now give it to cats. So that's a great update. You can now inject your cats with Summit.
Wow, that's really shifty. I wonder what the salespeople are saying about it now. I wonder if there's any new salespeople, because like I wonder what happened to the Facebook pages all about Summit. Like, what happened to all of that?
They have new Facebook pages
with like all the same people supporting it, saying how great it is.
So they only did this in March of this year, March 2022, The Facebook page has like no followers. It's a blank Facebook page. So I think I don't really know, but their website's gone. It's this Eternum Pier website now, which is like full of stock photos. I just thought it'd be a fun update for you guys since I was like talking about scammy injections. Polyglycan seemed really scammy to me. And speaking of one more scammy product, we're going to talk about Hyaluron. So this is a little bit confusing. So Hyaluron, which is sold by Zoetis currently, is a drug. Their original approval was issued in 1984. They did receive an updated approval in 2006, and I believe that was when Zoetis bought it. Their NADA number is 112048. There's not a lot about them online. Like, I can't find a ton of stuff about them. But from what I can find, it is basically the same thing as Legend. It has the same chemical makeup. It's 98% water and 1% HA, 1% a non-hazardous ingredient, whatever that is. That's cool. Actually, I was able to continue to dig further, and this is why I give you the NADA numbers, is because they actually, well, on their product, like their packaging they sell to you, they could say 1% non-hazardous ingredient. They actually have to tell the FDA what that is.
Yeah.
And in this case, it is, so they have sodium hyaluronate, sodium chloride, disodium hydrogen phosphate dehydrate, and sodium dihydrogen phosphate hydrate. It's just different sodium. It's really similar to Legend, so I don't really understand how this is a different product, and I don't know if this is just like Legend's patent has expired and so they've been able to change their formula to be more similar, because I don't think this was their formula the entire time, but this is their currently approved formula. So this one, it was in 2016, according to AAEP, was one of the more commonly injected products for HA. So you have Hyaluron V, Hyvisc, Legend, and Hylovit, which are all like pretty similar. This one is actually recommended to be injected into the hocks. And I find this really confusing because they say that you should do a 2 milliliter dose into the knees and a 4 milliliter dose into the hock joint. And then that confuses me. If there's less space in the hock joint, why would your dose be bigger?
Maybe they're not doing it in the bottom two. They're doing it in like the top part of the joint where it has more space.
Possibly. I don't know. I also think it's really interesting that like this product, I have really never heard of it. Like Legend is a barn hold name, but I've never heard of like Hyaluron until I like looked into it. And so I'm curious as to like what sort of differences Legend took in order to become so popular and such a like, you know, one of the first names you think of when you think of like joint injections. So here comes the issues with Hyaluron. It is currently not available for sale. So Zoetis was selling it back in 2015 on their website, and I found it in their catalogs. So if you want to know, Zoetis is the company that's making it, and this applies to all manufacturing products, because you probably want to double check this. It is an FDA approved drug, okay? So it absolutely is approved, absolutely approved for going into the joints, but they have not been selling it since probably 2015, 2016, somewhere in there. I couldn't find some of those catalogs. I was able to find their 2022 catalog, and they are absolutely not selling it in there. So you can find these companies' catalogs that of products that they sell to the vets. You can also look through their websites to figure out what products are available to vets. If your vet is selling you Hyaluron, run for the hills, because it is not being manufactured and sold.
Wow.
So FDA, so wait for it. So the FDA, they've not filed paperwork to close this product. So you do, if you want to stop manufacturing a product, you do have to file paperwork to say you're pulling, you're withdrawing the NADA number. They've not done that. So it makes me wonder if Zoetis is going to do some like reformulation of it, if they're going to relaunch it, rename it at some point.
Like have a comeback with it.
Exactly. But they've not done that at this point. So, but they are not selling it or manufacturing it. However, you can absolutely Google where to buy Hyaluron V and buy it online.
Oh.
From the world's sketchiest websites. And these are absolutely those websites. Don't know what I'm talking about. You need to go listen to our episode on the Juice Man.
Oh.
These websites are so insane to me. I found the one I looked at was bestequinemeds.com. Go take a gander around if you want to freak yourself out for a minute. What I love about these websites is how out in the open and how obvious they are. Bestequinemeds.com, it's not a scam, guys. You're buying illegal drugs. You're buying meth and speed for horses, including products that are no longer being sold.
They're like years old on the shelf.
That, or if there's something else they're doing as well.
Right. Oh my God. That's crazy. I did not expect it to take that kind of turn.
So I found on their website, so this is like their little like blurb underneath Hyaluron, where it says, buy Hyaluron 5 injection online from us at very competitive prices. We are 100% legit and efficient supplier of performance supplements for equine sports. If you have to say you're legit, you're not legit, okay? Also, like, legit, that's slang. Why are you using slang? Like, use the, we are a legitimate website. Like,
see, they're 100% legit. Too legit to quit.
Legit to quit. Like, what? This is what I love about these websites. Okay, it continues on. We offer the best market prices and offer a huge discount for bulk buyers.
Of course they offer the best market price. They're the only ones,
Robin,
selling it.
Actually, no, there's lots of these websites selling it.
Oh,
you can still buy it online. It's not that hard of a product to find and buy online.
That's even scarier.
Packaging and shipping are very discreet and bypass all custom or law enforcement.
What? Why would you... Oh my God. That's not sketchy. That's 100%
legit. 100%
legit.
What I love about these websites is that they were like, our customers are too stupid to get on the black web to find these, or the dark web. They're never going to find us on the dark web. We've got to put it in the most obvious spot. We've got to put it on bestequinemeds.com. Like, they're never going to find us otherwise. That's how dumb our clients are.
The casual, oh, we'll just slip in there that, don't worry, no customs. We get it right through police. Because that's what we need. Oh my God.
So again, if you're like, what are you guys talking about? Go and listen to our Juice Man episode, because I also found for sale, super sale price, by Green Speed Injection. Green Speed, that is the product. Don't worry, guys, it's an amino acid, vitamin, and mineral supplement. Let me read the description for Green Speed. It's also green. Green Speed Injection is a proprietary formula that increases the activity of the sympathetic nervous system and also produces a sense of euphoria and increased alertness.
Oh my God.
Why does my horse need a sense of euphoria? Like, what the heck?
Oh my God. They're selling straight drugs for these horses. My goodness.
Right? Also for dogs and camels.
I kind of want to buy this and just see what comes in the mail.
Right? Okay, so it is $250.
Oh, never mind.
I know. I really want to buy something from them too, though, because like, what do you mean by discreet? We'll bypass all customs and law enforcement?
Let's go in half. Have you together on the Green Speed. Let's see what comes in the mail.
What I also really want is, like, I want a lab where we can test this stuff at. Like,
yeah.
I know that I should not inject anything that is neon green into my horse. You don't have to tell me twice.
Or titled green speed.
I know that I'm not going to inject that into my horse. But so this is the website. This is the kind of websites you can buy hyaluronan on. Again, hyaluronan is a drug, an approved drug by the FDA. However, something else, so while it may be really old stock they're selling you, it also may be counterfeit. So a 2011 import ban was placed on hyaluronan by the FDA. And basically what they are seeing is that they are routinely receiving complaints from racetrack authorities about illegal use of these drugs. Although we are not sure exactly how these drugs enter the country, we suspect they enter in small lots which escape detection. All of these drugs may legally enter when consigned to the holder of a valid NADA, which they have. Also, apparently most of the illegal hyaluronic acid comes from Italy. Like, what's up, Italy? What you doing?
Interesting.
And I'm going to say his full name, a Dr. Lawrence Goldman from Jupiter, Florida, is also importing illegal Adequan into the United States. So he is importing the human version of Adequan and selling that to racehorses. And it's being smuggled in from Munich. So, come on, Florida. Like, why do you have to be this way?
Florida man strikes again.
I know. So with that, those are the things you should not inject into your horse's hocks. I'm going to hand it over to Robin, who's going to discuss the things you can put in your horse's hocks.
Wow, I don't know how to follow that up. I'm going to give you a real quick disclaimer. Mine is not going to involve any green speed drugs or anything like that.
Yeah, this is why this is what blows my mind is, like, you think that if your vet recommends hyaluronan, you would think at this point it would be safe. It's not. Whatever they're selling you is not good. I would run from that vet and the hills because.
Have you had a vet recommend hyaluronan?
No. I've never even heard of this. Heard of polyglycan. That one I have. There is also one more, which is oposantan or something, which is just for IM. So I didn't look further into that. But there are other things in this world that can be injected. But. Yeah, I just thought that was crazy that this is an actual drug that is being illegally smuggled into the U.S. still and sold on absolutely sketchy websites.
Wow, that is wild. I did not expect that at all. Well, I am not talking about that. What I am going to be talking about is I dubbed it the Arnold Schwarzenegger effect, which is just, we're talking about steroids. When you mention steroids, he's the first one that pops into mind.
I mean, steroids, that's what I think of is like bulking up, but I also think like, what don't steroids have like super scary effects? Like, is my horse going to like, I don't like their head's gonna get really big? Like, what, you know, like steroids, you're told as a kid, like how bad they are,
right? But actually, for steroids to work, like, you actually have to put in effort to get, like, you can't just take steroids and bulk up, you have to actually still be doing things to get that to activate a lot of times.
So, my horse isn't gonna develop roid rage,
no, he's just gonna develop road rage. Your horse in the back of the trailer with road rage just shaking his hoof. You dastardly Subaru.
I feel like Dublin had road rage.
Yeah, I think he did too. So there are two commonly used steroids for hock injections, and these are known as corticosteroids. Corticosteroids are the synthetic versions of cortico, which is a naturally occurring group of hormones that are normally produced by the two small adrenal glands, one of which lies next to each kidney of the horse. These hormones have many extremely important functions in the horse's body, and although chemically related, they are different from anabolic steroids used for weight gain or muscle development. Various synthetic hormones have been made in an attempt to help reproduce the beneficial effects that corticosteroids have, and they are part of medical therapy for many conditions. The most important effects of corticosteroids in medicine are as an anti-inflammatory, and they're aimed at reducing pain and swelling of musculoskeletal problems caused by inflammation, arthritis, which is in the joint, tendonitis, fasciitis in ligaments, and myositis in muscle. Since we are talking about hock injections, we are focusing on the joint. We are focusing on corticosteroids being used in the joint, which is mainly looking at things like arthritis. There are two types of corticosteroids commonly used, methylprednisolone acetate, also referred to as MPA, and triamcinolone acetonide, which is formerly referred to as TR. The first steroid we're going to dig into and take a look at is methylprednisolone acetate, which is MPA, and I'm going to refer to it as MPA from here on out because I'm going to trip all over that word if I try to say it too many more times. But they are most commonly supplied and sold by Depomedrol. And according to Depomedrol's label, it is meant to treat and act as an anti-inflammatory, treat certain types of allergies and arthritis. It's labeled, of course, for use in horses, and it is used for the treatment of pain and lameness associated with acute localized arthritic conditions and generalized arthritic conditions, including osteoarthritis, tendonitis, synovitis, and myositis. It is especially beneficial in relieving pruritus and inflammation of allergic dermatitis. Their labeling also states when not to use it. If your horse has tuberculosis, peptic ulcers, or Cushing syndrome, it is also advised to only use with extreme caution when it comes to pregnant mares, which I thought was interesting because a lot of times when you're looking at something that's dealing with arthritis, while it does happen in younger horses, you typically see it in older horses. So it's interesting that if your horse has Cushing's, don't use this with them.
Yeah, it's interesting because, yeah, typically you would have both, maybe.
Typically, Depomedrol is out of the system around this time frame, around 3 to 4 weeks, but it has been found remaining in the system for up to 70 days. And some of the most compelling clinical research done on MPA comes from Colorado State University. And this was done back in, I think, 1999 or 1998, where they have done a few clinical studies using a specific model where a chip of cartilage is removed surgically. Steroids are then injected into the joint at intervals, and the horses are exercised through a set exercise regime. The first study I took a look at by them was on methylprednisolone acetate, and it's called The Effects of 6-alpha methylprednisolone acetate on an Equine Osteochondral Fragment Exercise Model, where an osteochondral fragment, a chip, was created in one randomly chosen middle carpal joint of each horse. They used 18 horses in total, with three groups made up of six horses. They had polyionic fluid, PF, was injected into both middle carpal joints of the horses in the control group. In horses of the MPA controlled group, MPA was injected into the middle carpal joint without the osteochondral fragment, so it was injected in the joint without a chip. And then in the MPA treated group of horses, they used 100 milligrams of MPA that was injected into the middle carpal joint containing that osteochondral fragment. Injections were then administered post-surgical day 14 and day 28. Horses began being exercised on a high-speed treadmill for 8 weeks, starting on post-surgical day 15. What they found in this was that clinical improvement seen in the degree of lameness was not associated with MPA administration. Joints that contained an osteochondral fragment, so those joints that had a surgical chip created in them and were then treated with MPA, they had lower prostaglandin E2 concentration in synovial fluid and lower scores for intimal hyperplasia and vascularity in synovial membrane compared with PF-treated joints. However, articular cartilage erosion and morphologic lesions suggested possible deleterious effects of intra-articular MPA administration. What all that means, because that was really confusing.
Yeah, I was going to say, break that down like I'm five.
Yeah, so basically, MPA did helped a little bit, but the biggest change that they were seeing happen, because like from the control group to the group being using MPA, there was really no significant difference between the synovial fluid and the membranes. The biggest note they made was that MPA appeared to affect the cartilage and have accelerated cartilage degrading in the joint that it was injected in. Did that make sense?
No, it makes sense. And that is my understanding. Like, so much of my understanding around steroids is like, we have to be careful because these aren't great for cartilage. But then so much of the conversation in today's language is that, well, we have better steroids today, therefore they're fine, and that we're not using the same things that destroyed cartilage previously. So I guess my question is, when was this study done?
So this study was done in 1999. However, there has been quite a few studies since done on MPA, and consistently across the board, unfortunately, MPA shows that it does have a negative effect on cartilage, and that even though people have suggested injecting it in smaller doses, that way it doesn't have such a detrimental effect on the cartilage, those smaller doses really aren't effective.
So to get MPA to work, you have to inject it at a little bit of a higher dose, and then that cartilage, that negative impact, comes into play. And even when you do it in the smaller dose, it's just not effective. So unfortunately with MPA, it didn't have a huge impact on improving lamenesses, and it appeared to actually have a negative impact on the horse's cartilage. And that's seen across the board, unfortunately. Even with like newer studies that have been done, I went through a literature review that I will link that went through all the studies that have been done and looked at steroids, and they summarized it all. And this was, and they like broke down each study and talked about it, pretty much all of them with MPA, with like the exception of one or two, have seen a negative impact on the cartilage.
Okay, so this brings me back to my question earlier about the high motion versus low motion, because MPA is supposed to be used for low motion now?
Yes, it's injected in one of the lower two. It can be injected in, oh, I don't remember their names right now, but it goes in either the bottom two, depending on where that pain is, where that arthritis is, or whatever you're targeting is.
Well, because I'm so confused, because, and not like, not with you, I'm confused with, I didn't dig into steroids, but the information, I read a lot of like vet web pages that were like, no, steroids are safe now. We're not using the same steroids. It's better. We have like, don't worry about the cartilage being destroyed. That's like an old wives tale. And now I'm so confused. If the research says the complete opposite, then why are we like, what am I missing?
So the research for MPA does say that it harms the cartilage. May not harm today to the same extent that it used to, but it still does have a negative impact on that cartilage. However, if you remembered, there's two corticosteroids out on the market that we use to inject in the hocks. The second type is triamcinolone acetonide, frequently referred to as just TR. This one has been studied, and there was like one or two studies that was like, actually, it does have a negative impact on the cartilage, but those were like kind of one-off studies that I was reading.
Okay.
Most of them, it does not have that same impact on the cartilage.
Okay, that makes a little bit more sense, I guess.
It's most commonly supplied and sold by Vetilog or Adcortal. And you might be curious as to how triamcinolone lines up with MPA. And lucky for you, I have a study that looked at the use of both MPA and triamcinolone and how exactly those impacted horses with moderate to severe osteoarthritis. This study is called Retrospective Study of the Effect of Intra-Articular Treatment of Osteoarthritis of the Distal Tarsal Joints in 51 Horses. So they identified 51 horses and used them in this study through the University of Glasgow Veterinary School's database. And to qualify, the horses had to show improvement in lameness by 50% or more following the use of an analgesia, which is a strong pain reliever, kind of like a nerve block. And they had to have radiographic evidence of osteoarthritis. And they had to have received an intra-articular injection of MPA or TR with or without hyaluronic acid. So they're looking at quite a few different things, but really they're looking at what happened in horses with MPA injections, what happened to those with TR injections, or what happened to those that had a TR injection with hyaluronic acid, and what happened to those without hyaluronic acid. Like, did that hyaluronic acid really make a difference? They reviewed hospital records for those horses, collecting various information such as severity of lameness at initial and at follow-up examinations, the nature and extent of the horse's response to the treatment of affected joint, and how they looked a number of days afterwards. Not a number of days. It was like 2 years afterwards. They did a follow-up call with the owners to see, following those injections, what did your horse's career progress and like projected career look like several years down the road? Group one of these horses consisted of horses with moderate or severe radiographic evidence of osteoarthritis. Group two consisted of horses with mild or no osteoarthritis. And these were only included when the comparison between lame and sound horses were made. And what they found from this study was that those treated with either MPA or TR, regardless of hyaluronic acid, who saw an improvement, which was only about 38.2% of the horses became sound, saw that improvement around 56 days after treatment, and that there did not appear to be a significant difference between the use of MPA or TR. A handful of horses were treated twice. Second treatment on average was administered around 69 days, give or take a week, depending on the owner's availability after initial treatment, and those treated twice saw no significant improvement with further treatment. All the horses either remained lame, or if they saw an initial improvement after the first treatment, that progress kind of flatlined and didn't continue with the second administration. A big part of this is that many of the horses in this study ended up being kind of eliminated towards the end because
before they could get rechecked for soundness, they had another lameness come up that was unrelated to their arthritis. So they had something else happen with their body that continued on them being lame. So that kind of goes to show that, was it really the steroids not being effective, or was it the hawk not necessarily being the only thing wrong?
Right. I think, you know, and this is what I was trying to talk about in the beginning, is that I think the hawk is just a like symptom of something bigger going on, that they're not the cause of the lamenesses and problems you're seeing.
Also, so I'll dig into it a little bit more with this study, but a lot of these horses, I think it was 25 out of 51 of these horses were lame in both hind end, or like both hind limbs. So these were pretty severe cases of osteoarthritis. So it's worth noting that the horses with the greatest improvement in lameness had less frequent signs of moderate to severe osteoarthritis, and they received intra-articular treatments on those joints less often than those other horses. So those that saw the greatest improvement and that did become sound had like the less severe osteoarthritis. Those that were severely lame in both hind limbs and only saw moderate improvement, and then upon the second treatment saw no improvement, had the most severe arthritis going on, and then had additional things piling onto that.
So that then does back up the claim that you need to do this sooner, not later, if you think you're going to see improvements.
I mean, yes and no, because these aren't intended for long-term use. That's really the big thing about it, and I'll get to that in my conclusion.
Sure.
But finally, in this study, they took a look at radiographs following treatment and noted, and this is kind of what you're talking about with the vets, that, you know, they might not always hit the spot right on the dot every single time, but it might not necessarily be as detrimental as we think it is that horses in which the uptake of radiopharmaceuticals was diffused showed significant improvement in their lameness grades after being treated once, but the horses where uptake was focal and did not diffuse, they had less improvement.
So maybe it's good that your vet can't hit the target.
Maybe it's okay. Maybe it works. And that the overall success outcome being 38.2% of the horses, which is less than ideal and is less than what has been reported for surgical treatment, suggests that surgical treatment is a better option if you're looking for long-term management of osteoarthritis.
Did they, and maybe you said this and I missed it, what were the dosings that they were giving of the drugs?
I don't have that information actually, because so they weren't the ones dosing the horses. These horses were dosed at the clinic, and so they were pulling up what the clinician diagnosed the horses, dosed them, what their radiographs were showing, and then what their improvement was, and they used the AAEP standard for lameness detection and scaled them on the from 0 to 5, which 0 being no lameness detective and 5 being not load bearing on that leg.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, I understand that this was...
So it kind of sucks that it wasn't them running the study exactly. This was horses out and about just with their owners. But I also like that, because that's the kind of results that you'll be seeing, you and I would see, that our listeners would see.
Well, and I actually do notice, like, a lot of the studies I did look at did actually take horses that already had issues. It was only really that one study I found that was paid for by the investment firm that killed the horses. Most of the studies were, that's what blows my mind, is that this investment firm that is looking at products to help the horses, just killing them. Most of these were actually using real situations and looking at horses, right, that were lame. Because I did look through like a lot of these different studies looking at some of the other products, and they were basically real life scenarios grabbing horses that fit a certain description.
Most of us here that are looking at hawk injections aren't necessarily looking at hawk injections for later in life. We're looking at them to keep a rideable horse rideable. I mean, that previous study didn't really look at that in terms of TR. The MPA study did look at it, but they didn't really find a relation between the use of MPA and the horse's soundness. However, Colorado State University did another study that looked at TR, and they used the same model of creating a chip in the joint and then treating with TR and then exercising those horses. And it resulted in entirely different results than those seen with MPA. And this was conducted around the same year. So I think this was 1999, 1998, somewhere in there. The effects of triamcinolone acetonide on an in vivo equine osteochondral fragment exercise model. So like in their MPA study, they took 18 horses once again,
broke them into three groups of six different horses, which I really like just how similar they were keeping these studies, because I think it shows a really great side-by-side comparison, especially when exercise is brought into this.
For sure, yeah.
So once again, a chip was created in one randomly chosen intercarpal joint of each horse. Both intercarpal joints in the placebo group were injected with an intra-articular administration of polyonic fluid. Both joints in the TR control group were treated with 12 milligrams of TR in the intercarpal joint without a chip, and the opposite intercarpal joint was injected with a similar volume of polyonic fluid. And then the TR-treated group, those with a chip, were treated with 12 milligrams of TR in the joint that contained the chip, and the opposite intercarpal joint was injected with a similar volume of polyonic fluid. All horses were then treated on both days 13 and 27 after surgery and exercised on a high-speed treadmill for 6 weeks starting on day 14 post-surgery. What they found was that the horses in the treated group were significantly less lame than the horses in the controlled groups. Those who had been injected with TR had lower total protein and higher hyaluron glucosamine glycan concentrations in synovial fluid than the horses from the controlled group. Synovial membrane collected from those injections that received TR has significantly less inflammatory cell infiltration. And finally, they examined the articular cartilage parameters, and they were significantly better in those that were treated with TR than the control group. So overall results from this study were favorable towards the effects of TR with clinically detectable lameness and on synovial fluid and membrane. That all got better and looked better with those injections. And it also did not appear to have the same accelerated cartilage degradation that MPA appeared to have.
Interesting. So skip the depo-metadrol and go for Vetalog is what you're saying.
Pretty much. There have been people that have popped up, which, you know, everything has its drawback, where MPA appears to have a negative impact on cartilage. TR has its own drawback, and that is laminitis.
Oh, fantastic.
However, I'm only going to touch on this briefly because it's not as prevalent as people that really dislike the steroids would make it out to be. In spite of these concerns that it causes laminitis, there's actually no direct causal link that has been established, and there's no exact dosage or magic number to avoid that can be given to horses that will, you know, induce and develop laminitis.
I think it's an allergic reaction, isn't it?
It can be. It really depends on the horse. It's hard to explain because that concern is there, but it's not a likely outcome.
Yeah.
The few studies I read through that talked about it and looked at it where it happened and it did occur in horses, it was occurring in horses that had previously been affected by laminitis. It wasn't occurring in just every horse.
Okay. Like a flare up.
Yeah, it would be one of those situations, or a horse that was severely overweight that, you know, had maybe brushed up against the laminitis but never quite got there. Not way more likely, but it was more likely to happen in those one-off instances. But it really is not very common that it happens.
Well, and you wonder, laminitis can be really, really hard to diagnose and to notice the early signs of it. So you could be seeing a horse that's slowed down thinking it needs hock injections, but really it has laminitis. But for whatever reason, it doesn't appear. Right? Because if you're lame on two front feet, it's a lot harder to diagnose and recognize than, you know, if you're lame on one front foot. I could see a situation in which you don't realize your horse has laminitis until it's been aggravated due to hock injections. That it already had it, you just didn't know it.
Right, exactly. And I mean, if you're using high doses and prolonged use of longer acting, like systemic steroid products, that is a risk factor for causing laminitis. But that kind of applies to both steroids. It's not just only on TR, that's also on MPA. And MPA also comes with the negative impacts on cartilage. To wrap up the Arnold Schwarzenegger steroid part of all of this, I think it's important to remember that corticosteroids are not a cure, especially for chronic long-standing conditions such as osteoarthritis, which we saw in the second study I covered, that even horses that were receiving treatments when they were a few years down the road were still suffering, and you're not going to use it for years on end. That's not the intended purpose of corticosteroids. Yes, all the studies I looked at and we talked about were evaluating how these steroids impacted osteoarthritis, or at least the one was, and a lot of the studies do look at it, but that was mainly to determine that the anti-inflammatory effects are useful. And they totally are. They work. They do work as an effective anti-inflammatory. But the relief they offer from pain and lameness is typically only temporary,
especially in those joints affected with chronic osteoarthritis. At the end of the day, both corticosteroids are intended for short-term use, and there's a good bit of evidence to show that when used in excessive amounts or with excessive frequency, they can have harmful effects on the horse's joints. Corticosteroids should never be injected indiscriminately or used for maintenance or otherwise normal joints. Corticosteroids injections are not harmless, as they are an invasive procedure, and they do carry the risk of causing infection or causing more inflammation that you're trying to reduce.
If you've done your research, spoke with your vet, you have a plan of action laid out, knowing that the use of corticosteroids is going to only be for the short term, I would recommend using triamcinolone rather than MPA.
So I'm curious if you found this with any of your research, is that how many of the studies actually looked at the hocks versus the knees?
None.
Right. Like, I found that as well. I found the only studies that looked at the hocks, because, and this was really the only time I could find it, was diffusion studies that were looking at how much therapeutic benefit there is when you only inject one location. Very few were looking at the hock itself. And I wonder, the knee and the hock are just so different. I wonder if there is some difference, some benefit to the hock versus the knee, but I couldn't find much research. And again, my products I really didn't dig too deep for, because it was like, well, don't do that. But most of them were looking at the knee. And I know the knee, as we've discussed this earlier, is just easier to x-ray, it's easier to access, you're less likely to be kicked. But like, we then promote these things to be injected and approved to be injected into the hocks. So like, why aren't we looking as deeply at the hocks as we are at the knee?
I don't have an answer for you on that, so sorry. Just gonna leave you hanging on that one. That's a cliffhanger.
Well, I was just curious because I found the same stuff within looking at a lot of my products, and I just didn't really understand why when we hock injections are not. I feel like knee injections are novel. Like, we don't really hear about knee injections the same way we hear about hock injections. Like, hock injections are standard in a lot of barns, yet the research really has been focused around knees and not hocks.
Right, exactly.
I mean, I'm sure there's absolutely hock research out there. It just wasn't the top of the list when looking on the first like 2 pages or 3 pages of Google Scholar.
No, it wasn't. And a lot of things, when you're going to look at them, like that one specific study, my second study I talked about, did look at hind limb lameness. It's hard to figure out, you know, what if the joint that they're applying that steroid to or that injection to is going to affect the next joint the same way.
The studies are looking at the joint itself, and I want, you know, there's not a ton that are looking at the long-term benefits to the entire body. Like, that's, again, like, right, we discuss this, it's a whole horse, you know, approach. And if you're just looking at the hocks, does that change my horse's gait in other ways? Are there other improvements being made, or did it just affect him in this small little way?
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. But it's weird because hock injections are so widely pushed. I mean, that's the thing, is that they are so unanimous with performance horses, and I feel like they shouldn't necessarily be. I don't know.
I don't fully understand it. I mean, I know, for example, like, a lot of these companies that sell these products partners with AAEP, right? They, like, for example, Adequin, that product, they partner with AAEP. They are one of their educational partners, and they do continuing education classes and all sorts of funding and support for the vets.
Yeah.
Right. Which, okay, I can see how after you go to a class about a certain product and why it's the best product and why it works better than everybody else's and more horses need it, why more horses then get it. I do think there is a question about why some of these products are so prevalent and what that relationship truly is. I know David Ramey, he is a vet that is very anti a lot of our typical procedures. I don't use his information a ton of the time, just because not because he's wrong, but just because he is known for being so one-sided, but did just release a chapter in a book about the ethics of vets. And a lot of these things are questioned in that book, I know. So it's just an interesting, I'm not saying your vet is unethical because they recommend hock injections. I would question a vet that recommends hock injections without doing a full lameness workup, a, you know, full exam, doing lameness diagnostics for the entire body, doing nerve and joint blocks, doing radiographs or ultrasounds or MRIs. I would be concerned if that my vet just threw out the idea of hock and joints without looking at the rest
but
of the
I can
picture.
See where it comes to be really tempting to just go with hock and joints because all the other things you mentioned, it all costs money. It's all really expensive. And just settling for hock injections.
It all costs money, yeah.
It's not cheap, but it's a cheaper option than everything else. And if it makes the horse a little bit better, it's hard. It feels like you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. And all you're trying to do is what's best for your horse and what you can afford. Because, I mean, that's another part of it is that not everything is feasible nor affordable. I mean, looking at the osteoarthritis, which is probably going to affect the hock the most, and that is what most of these injections are looking at to help. The best fix for that is going to be probably surgery, and that all adds up money-wise, and it's hard on your horse's body. Like, it's just...
Yeah, I mean, doing the right thing is absolutely expensive for horses. They definitely do that on purpose.
It's never the cheap option.
It's never the cheap option. It never is. I think, however, the cheap option could absolutely be proper rehab and conditioning your horse properly and starting from day one, understanding what your outcome is going to be. We are going to develop arthritis, and how do I avoid it through healthy work? I think that's sort of one of the biggest things that I think we rely a lot on. Well, I'll give my horse joint supplements and he'll be good and I can do whatever I want. And those things don't work. I think the push needs to be preventative. And it needs to start with proper biomechanics and proper movement and balance and proper conditioning and understanding how to avoid it versus wanting to just address it when it's time.
That's the ideal, but not everyone gets the horse right at the beginning of their life. Not everyone, you know, you don't always come around and figure things out right at the beginning. I mean, I know I certainly haven't figured anything out. So like,
I don't disagree with that. I just think that arthritis isn't something you're going to be able to avoid, and it's not something that you're going to be able to medicate away. And realize that these are signs that your horse needs to slow down and needs to have physical changes made, and that it trying to inject your horses to make them work for you longer, is that necessary?
Cool. On that note, I think we are done. We covered all the information we wanted to cover, talked about all the different injections out there on the market that are approved to be used in the hock and the joint. That is the hock. Well, I guess all four joints that are the hock. Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you learned something. I hope this helped you figure something out about hock injections, whether you're for it, against it, whether you're not going to use the Hyaluronan or Hyalurate. Well, don't use that one. The one that's sold alongside of Speed, don't use that one. But if you guys have any comments, questions, concerns, other topics you want us to cover, feel free to reach out to us on Instagram at inthebarn.pod. Or you can hit us up at inthebarnpod@gmail.com. And on that note, remember to stay safe, stay classy, and stay in the saddle.
And think before you inject.
Unless you're doing speed, then always inject.
Okay, no. If something is neon green, do not put it in your horse, no matter how legit the website.